From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jeremy Hobson is off. Hope you're having a happy new year so far. President Trump started his with another tweet today about the weekend-long violent protests in Iran, writing, "Iran is failing at every level despite the terrible deal made with them by the Obama administration. The great Iranian people have been repressed for many years. They are hungry for food and for freedom, along with human rights. The wealth of Iran is being looted." Then in all caps, "Time for change." Well, the president is referring there to the deal made by the Obama administration that lifted sanctions against Iran, unfreezing $100 billion in assets in exchange for Iran tamping down its nuclear program. Borzu Dargahi is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He's been watching from Istanbul. He joins us by Skype. And Borzu, some analysts here are saying some Iranians have benefited from the sanctions being lifted, and these protesters are coming from a more conservative part of the country that did not benefit.
First of all, I would say that this protest has nothing to do with Trump or the U.S. or U.S. policy and so on, except insofar as the removal of sanctions really raised expectations among a lot of Iranians. And as we know, raised expectations are what, you know, cause revolution. People who are oppressed and oppressed and oppressed and poor and poorer and poorer don't rise up. But when you raise their hopes and then dash those hopes, there's a lot of anger. And I think that's what's happening in Iran right now. I should give a few caveats. In 2009, I covered the uprising in Iran. I knew so many protesters. You know, I was so plugged into what was happening there. I have not spoken to a single protester in Iran. Not only have I not spoken to, I don't know anyone who has spoken to any of the protesters, and I've not read a single quote from any media that actually quotes one of the protesters, except for things they say on videos that are uploaded and sent out of the country.
Well, and what does this tell you? I mean, about who is, you know, doing the uprising and dying?
I think it's a strata of Iranian society that is forgotten. Lower class and lower middle class people who are very, very much and frustrated and have been very frustrated by the economic dynamics that are, you know, unfolding in Iran. I can tell you, I live in Istanbul, and over the last 2 or 3 years, you can just see a big, huge flood of Iranian tourists coming here and spending money. So some people are definitely benefiting from the nuclear deal and from the changing economics of Iran post-sanctions. But these are the people who are not benefiting from it. These are the people who don't have decent jobs with companies that have international deals or international contracts. These are the people who don't have access to wealth, not able to travel, don't have passports. This is a lot more similar to what happened in Tunisia and Syria in 2010 and 2011, where people in the rural countryside rose up over economic frustration than to what happened in 2009 or during the uprisings in Eastern Europe during the early 90s and so on.
In the Arab Spring. Well, you also write the protesters appear unheedful of and untethered to any of Iran's political factions or, you know, civil society streams. So there's nobody to leverage them with. But they may be influenced by something called the Mujahideen Khalq, MKO. Tell us who they are and what that tells you.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization is a very controversial group. It was formerly listed as a terrorist organization by the U.S. I consider them a cult-like Marxist-Islamist organization, very bizarre a group of people who somehow seem to have gotten access to Western money and especially certain U.S. officials, people like Rudy Giuliani. They seem to have hired on as lobbyists and so on their behalf. And, you know, they're a very toxic organization to most Iranians. They consider them like basically untouchable because they sided with Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war against the Iranian people. Now, I don't think these protesters are part of the MKO, but the danger is that untethered to any of the legitimate political factions, the government could really crack down on them and no one will care.
Well, will no one care? I mean, after the 2009 uprising, there were questions about whether or not the United States should have used that moment to help the people in overthrow that government. Now we have President Trump egging the protesters on through Twitter. Do you think the United States will try to seize on this moment somehow?
I don't think that it could. I mean, what could it do? This is an Iranian story. Iranians have been fighting for democracy for 112 years. This goes way back. Mm-hmm. And this is a fight between, you know, autocrats and Democrats that, you know, goes back to the Persian poets who've written about the kind of evils of tyranny and ways to fight back against tyranny. So this is a long saga, and I don't think that, you know, what one Western government or another does is going to really matter much.
Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed, speaking to us from Istanbul. Borzu, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
So it is the new year, and it's starting in California with the first legal recreational marijuana sales for adults 21 and older. 8 states and D.C. have legalized marijuana. 5 have markets in place, including, of course, Colorado. Californians voted for legalization in 2016. Its illegal market was estimated at over $13 billion. Taxes on the legal sales are expected to generate between $300 and $500 million this year alone. Khalil Mutawakil is co-founder of Kind Peoples. That's a cannabis medical dispensary in Santa Cruz and one of the first to get a license for today's recreational sales. Khalil, you opened at 7 a.m. How'd it go?
Well, we had a long line around the block.
Really?
And we began with a ribbon cutting ceremony this morning with our local county supervisor. We actually had our first people in line coming all the way from Florida. And the shelves are stocked, the line's moving, and there's just tons of happy folks with smiles on their faces and celebrating the end of prohibition.
Well, and what are your questions, though, especially as somebody who's been obviously doing this for a while? There was concern from some of the smaller growers in California that a lot of sophisticated people from other industries would be starting to move into the state to try to take over the industry. You know, people who knew more about marketing and branding and, you know, legal businesses. Are you worried about that?
I am worried about that. The new regulations set up a brand new backbone for how the industry will operate. So, of course, I'm worried about supply issues and overall volatility within the market. But most of all, who are the losers going to be? You know, I think there are going to be a lot of small businesses supporting middle-class families that are going to have a hard time assimilating into the new paradigm of statewide regulation.
Right. Well, and also some of the smaller businesses, you know, there are estimates that half of the cannabis grown in California is illegally shipped across state lines and sold, you know, at a higher price to people across the country who don't have the ability to farm it year round. You know, what happens to that business? I'm sure you've talked to other distributors. Are they going to have some legal business and some illegal?
Well, my hope is that the folks that may be operating in the shadows will see the new regulations as an opportunity to engage in the legal marketplace, which is expected to greatly expand over the coming years.
Yeah. And what did you have to do to get ready to sell? You've already done all the work to sell medical marijuana, but what did you have to do? You mentioned regulations to sell recreational.
Well, we've had the amazing fortune of a highly cooperative local government here, which is really the key to obtaining your state license. So we applied for multiple license types with the new California Bureau of Cannabis Control. We were more than thrilled to find out that we had actually received 8 out of the first 20 cannabis licenses given in the state of California.
You had licenses for retail, to sell, for distribution, for cultivation and manufacturing. So there is a lot of licensing.
Correct. Yeah, we're looking to be a vertically integrated operation where we can provide patients and customers in both the medical and the adult use market with product that we have procured all the way from seed to sale for them.
Yeah. Well, and right now you're able to sell your marijuana without full regulatory controls, but eventually you're going to have to test your product. This is going to be a state requirement extensively. Track it from seed to sale. You've already said you think some smaller growers may not make it through this regulatory network, but how is it going to change how you operate?
Well, you know, luckily for us, I think it's going to make things quite a bit smoother. When folks walk in the door now, all you have to do is show your government-issued ID and verify that you are 21 years of age or older. And, you know, we're looking forward to bringing in a lot of tax revenue, both for our local municipality as well as for the state.
Well, and you know, police are worried. They have concerns about driving under the influence, the message it sends to kids. What do you do about that?
Well, I think that we can look to other legalized states like Colorado and Washington, where according to the data, there really hasn't been any changes in car crash rates. And here in California, we do have laws already on the books to identify impaired drivers. But here at Kind Peoples, we also have launched a public service campaign to go low and slow, and it has five aspects. First, take a low dose, and second, go slow, wait 2 hours, and make sure that the dose is kicked in. We recommend, of course, not to drive, don't mix with alcohol, and then make sure to lock your product up.
Wow, it's a new day. Did you ever think you'd see it?
Well, you know, I've been in this business now for 5 years, and certainly we're thrilled to be here today and celebrate the end of Prohibition.
That's Khalil Mutawakil, co-founder of Kind Peoples, a cannabis dispensary in Santa Cruz, California, on this the first day of the legal sale of recreational marijuana. Khalil, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Some of you are probably still in your jammies, I'm sure. So sit back for a great story about the U.S. and Canada. The two neighbors are close allies now, but that wasn't always the case. Martin Kessler from member station WBUR has this story about the turning point and a college hockey program that grew out of it.
Picture the House chamber at the U.S. Capitol. It's 1911, and the Speaker of the House, a guy named Champ Clark, takes the floor and says,
"I look forward to the time when the American flag will fly over every square foot of British North America up to the North Pole."
The Speaker of the House, the Paul Ryan of his day, actively advocates for the annexation of Canada. That's his whole point.
That's John Bacon, author of The Great Halifax Explosion.
He received loud cheers and a great write-up in the Washington Post. So that's how unfriendly we were as late as 1911.
Meanwhile, north of the border, lots of people were not too fond of the U.S. Joseph Bars was one of them. He's also the guy at the center of this story. Bars was 19 years old in 1911, and he had basically been born to hate the United States. It was in his blood. His ancestors had once lived in Massachusetts, but fled to Nova Scotia as tensions rose between the colonists and England.
They were loyal to the crown and not to the rebels, the revolutionaries, of course.
When the American Revolutionary War started, Bars' great-great-grandfather fought on the British side. But Bars was named after his great-grandfather, who was even more fearsome.
He captures, burns, or sinks more than 60 American ships during the War of 1812, so much so that he becomes the most wanted man in America. And that is our hero's great-grandfather.
Joseph Bars grew up in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. He was just 5'8", but he was strong. He starred on the hockey team at Acadia University. Not long after graduation, he found a personal reason to hate the United States. In 1915, he gave up a comfortable job in Montreal to join the Canadian Army in the trenches of World War I. He was angry that the United States wasn't yet sending troops. Soon he had bigger problems. At the Battle of Montsorel in Belgium in 1916, a German trench mortar nearly killed him. Bars was in a body cast for 6 months, then returned to Wolfville, Nova Scotia, about an hour from Halifax, to recuperate. The man who'd once been strong enough to do a lap around the rink on unlaced ice skates now struggled to move his left foot.
He comes back and he's kind of a lost soul, essentially. He does not want to go back to Montreal and be a businessman. He does not want to take over his dad's grocery store, which his dad thought he would. So he's lost, looking for a sense of purpose, and he finds it by accident.
In November 1917, Russia dropped out of the war. This meant the Germans could focus on the Western Front, and that made the Allies very nervous. They decided they needed more firepower. A French freighter called the Mont Blanc went to New York to stock up on airplane fuel and explosives. Then it headed north to meet a convoy in Halifax that would then leave for Europe. The Mont Blanc was packed with 6 million pounds of TNT and another explosive called picric acid.
You're not allowed to have matches on your person anywhere near the ship. And in a smoking era, that's a four-day sacrifice these French guys are not used to. So that's how terrified they are of this thing blowing up. And it crawls up the coast to Halifax.
German U-boats had already sunk 3,000 Allied ships, so the Mont Blanc crew was itching to get into Halifax Harbor.
These guys are terrified of getting blown up. Another ship, the Emo, a Norwegian supply ship, It's already a day late and wants to get to New York to load up with various relief supplies. They have no idea what Mont Blanc has got on it. Only like five guys in the harbor who aren't on the ship know about this. Emo is in a hurry that morning, and it keeps on passing ships on the left. That is against nautical convention.
Both the Mont Blanc and the Emo reach the narrows of the Halifax Harbor at the same time, heading right at each other.
And Mont Blanc thinks this guy is crazy and has one blast on the horn, which means I'm in the right place, you need to move. And Emo comes back with two blasts, saying, screw you, I'm going this way. Finally, at the last second, Mont Blanc realizes this guy's crazy, so it bails to the left to the middle of the harbor, just as Emo does the same thing.
They collided. It wasn't a big collision, but it was enough to knock over barrels of airplane fuel on the Mont Blanc. The ghost ship, now on fire, continued toward Pier 6 in Halifax Harbor. On land, one of the guys who knew what the Mont Blanc was carrying started hollering that the ship was going to blow and everyone needed to run. A train dispatcher named Vincent Coleman heard the message and started to run for his life.
And then he stops, because he remembers that the number 10 train from New Brunswick is coming in 5 minutes. It's going to park right in front of Pier 6. And if it does, everyone's going to die. So he runs back to the telegram office and starts furiously clacking off these messages to other train stations saying the following. Hold up the train. Ammunition ship afire in harbor, making for Pier 6 and will explode. Guess this will be my last message. Goodbye, boys. And those are his last words.
At 9:04 in the morning, the Mont Blanc exploded.
In that split second, 25,000 people are homeless, half the city is gone, 9,000 are wounded, and 2,000 are dead.
For the next 3.5 hours, all the telegraph lines in Halifax were down. But thanks to that final message from Vincent Coleman, word started to spread. And that's how Joseph Bars and the people in Wolfville, about 60 miles away, got the news.
A doctor friend of his says, you know first aid, you gotta come and help me.
Bars, still walking with a cane, boarded the next train for Halifax and ended up at Camp Hill Hospital. The hospital was packed. There were so many people in need of help that doctors ran out of anesthesia. They kept operating. For the next 14 straight hours, Bars dressed wounds, set fractures, and even helped with surgeries, something he'd never done before. Meanwhile, Vincent Coleman's message had also gotten to Boston. The Massachusetts governor called an emergency meeting and, without waiting to hear back from anyone in Halifax, decided to send a train filled with doctors, nurses, and medical supplies. Bars kept working in the hospital. After about 3 days, he was finally relieved by the doctors from Boston. One Nova Scotia historian wrote, "Substantial help was on the way from Toronto and Montreal. But the first and most valuable assistance came from that ancient foe beyond the Bay of Fundy, Boston, Massachusetts."
And that is when the U.S. and Canadian relationship starts to change, and very dramatically. And Bars himself, very anti-American for a lot of reasons, he says, "I will never be able to say enough about the wonderful help the states have sent. The response was so spontaneous and everything done even before it was asked for. It brought tears to all our eyes. You know, we've always been a trifle contemptuous of the United States. But never again. They can have anything I've got, and I don't think I feel any differently from anyone else down here either."
On the train ride back to Wolfville, Bars, the man who'd been so lost, realized what he wanted to do with his life. He would become a doctor. And instead of going to a Canadian university, Bars enrolled at the University of Michigan. There, he started to skate at Michigan's Coliseum. This was the steel and concrete three-walled building that housed the hockey rink. Bars slowly made his way around the ice, trying to regain control of his injured foot. By 1922, he was healthy enough to referee the club hockey team's games.
And finally he walks down to the athletic director's office, Fielding Yost, who built the big house in Ann Arbor, one of the most legendary coaches out there. And Bars says, "You need a hockey program." Yost is from West Virginia and born in 1871, the son of a Confederate soldier. So this guy does not know a damn thing about hockey, rest assured. But he saw something in Bars that he must have liked. And Fielding Yost says, "Only if you're the first coach." And he gives him the full rein and the funding for it. So that is how the University of Michigan got hockey.
For the next 5 years, Barz shuttled between his med school classes and the hockey rink. He coached Michigan to 2 league titles. The team was popular. In that early success mattered. During the Great Depression and World War II, many schools in the Midwest dropped their hockey programs. But not Michigan. The Wolverines have since gone on to win 9 national championships, more than any other program in the country. Meanwhile, Boston and Halifax have stayed connected. Every year, Nova Scotia sends a 50-foot, 2-ton Christmas tree to Boston as thanks for the city's help after the explosion.
3, 2, 1!
Light that tree!
As for Joseph Barz, after finishing medical school, he became the chief of surgery at a veterans hospital in Chicago, then opened his own practice. Oh, and one last thing. Joseph Barz, great-grandson of the guy who sank all those American ships, wound up marrying a woman from Battle Creek, Michigan. He became an American citizen. For Here and Now, I'm Martin Kessler.
And Martin's story comes to us from our colleagues at NPR's Only a Game. And while we're in a thoughtful mood, we want to note the passing of Yale professor and mathematician Tsuneo Tamagawa. He introduced the Tamagawa numbers, an algebraic measurement. More important, he was the beloved father of our colleague Emiko, and our thoughts are with the Tamagawa family. It's Here and Now. For 50 years, collectors of all stripes from across the country have turned to antiques and collectibles expert Terry Cavell. The Shaker Heights, Ohio resident has scores of antique toys, outdated kitchen gadgets, various pottery packed in the home office she and her late husband Ralph built in the 1950s. Here now, contributor David C. Barnett of WCPN IdeaStream takes us on a visit to this busy operation where Terry holds court over cast-off bits of pop culture.
Terry Covell says the start of her obsession with collectibles dates back to a purchase she made almost 80 years ago.
A mustache cup.
She inspects this ceramic vessel decorated with purple and gold flowers and points out a porcelain strip across the rim on one side of the cup to protect a gentleman's mustache from getting soaked when he sips a cup of coffee.
We were at Niagara Falls, and I had been given, I think it may have been $1 to spend. And my mother kept saying, I'm going to take the money back if you don't buy something. So I looked at everything and I decided I'd buy this cup for a quarter.
Covell says she doesn't know why she decided on the mustache cup exactly, but it was ground zero for a stockpile of stuff that continues to grow. Her home is filled with a wide-ranging collection, everything from classy to kitsch, ancient egg beaters, vintage road signs, and countless other objects.
It is something that's in the genes, I'm convinced. And somebody claims in some of the psychology things that it's like nuts and squirrels. The squirrel that can get the best nut is the one that survives.
And the Covells established an antiques and collectibles empire that has survived for more than 60 years, starting in 1953 with a book explaining the identification marks stamped onto the bases of pottery.
The book went 42 printings. It went out of print and it's now online. And we did it by hand drawing every picture. It was unheard of.
Terry Covell suspects that the success of the first book was a case of really good timing. They got their start at the same time that the American collecting hobby began.
The soldiers all came back from Germany, and they'd seen castles and houses with rooms full of plates hanging on the wall, and they all brought home Hummel figures for Mama. And then they wanted another Hummel figure.
And another, and another. A salesman by trade, Ralph Covell used his marketing skills to convince legendary Cleveland Press editor Louis Seltzer to let the couple write a column for 6 weeks in 1954. The Covells' Antiques and Collecting column has since been syndicated to hundreds of newspapers across the country, and that led to a nationally distributed television program years before Antiques Roadshow.
I saw that back there, but I don't know where the banana
was. Probably is near it. I mean, he was going to do
Terry Covell has a staff of researchers and assistants who work out of her house. The walls of three converted garages are lined with 18,000 reference books, which she's used to produce 100 publications, half of them price guides that collectors consult to learn the value of everything from Beanie Babies to handbags to athletic sneakers.
It's a way of life. And if you're not a collector, like my son, you don't understand it at all.
And so the obsession continues in this Shaker Heights home, brimming with milk cartons and signs and games and Egyptian revival furniture and paintings and plates, a mustache cup, and other pieces of America's past. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
The Thomas Fire in Southern California is still burning a month after it began. The road to recovery could be months, and all I have to do is look north to see that, because in Northern California, damage estimates from the October wildfires have reached $9 billion in wine country alone. The fires tore through cities like Santa Rosa, where thousands of homes, schools, and businesses were destroyed. At least 45 people died, and of course, that's the biggest loss. Shirley Zane is supervisor of Sonoma County's District 3, which includes parts of Santa Rosa. We spoke with her in October after she took a helicopter tour.
I saw devastation everywhere. I saw thousands of homes that have been lost. We have literally overnight displaced thousands of people with these infernos and hellish fires.
So what's happening 3 months later when all of your records are gone or you still don't have somewhere to live because housing was already tough in this area? Shirley Zane joins us again by Skype. Supervisor Zane, I would say Happy New Year, but I know it's a tough one.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep the word happy, quite frankly, out of my vocabulary right now because people are suffering and I think it's rather insensitive. I think people, you know, the human element in the most devastating fire in U.S. history, which hit Sonoma County, is so important to stress, Robin. People are not just rebuilding their houses and having to go through all those jumps and hurdles through insurance companies and reimbursements and FEMA and on and permitting. People are rebuilding their lives, and I think that's important. You know, so often on the top news stories, you see the latest disaster, but what you often don't see is the many months and years that follow in terms of what people need to do to recover. You know, a county of 500,000, a city of 160,000, and suddenly there's 10,000 people overnight who have literally become homeless.
Well, let's talk about that. We've spoke about that quite a bit here on the program.
Yeah.
And one of the side effects of this is that maybe landlords who owned homes they were renting, if the landlord's home burned, then they are kicking out tenants to move into
yes.
the homes they might have been renting. I mean, the
yes.
ripple effect here has been incredible. Several landlords were charged with price gouging, and
yep.
Governor Brown had a ban on rental increases of more than 10%. He's now extended that until April. But still, the housing was tough in your area anyway. So are people
yeah.
in homeless shelters or with family?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, a lot of people have been in things like hotels. I talked to a doctor friend of mine who's been living with her family and her two kids in a hotel for 4 weeks now. We had a vacancy rate of approximately 2% with a median home price of $600,000 prior to the fire. So there are landlords that have had to move back into their rentals and mm-hmm. displaced people. There has been a ripple effect. It's affected businesses. It's affected children's education. We lost schools that burned down. We thrive on tourism in this beautiful wine country where we live. And there was a tremendous decline in tourism when mm-hmm. people saw us burning down. We have people who are going through tremendous grief, having lost everything they owned, literally running for their lives in bare feet and not having an opportunity to grab anything. People lost animals. And they're going through tremendous grief, and that grief, you know, goes through phases, but it's only just begun, and it's not a linear process. It is more, a little bit more of a chaotic process is the way I describe it.
Well, we'll link people to, you know, one of the most devastating losses of all. It's unspeakable, but the Shepherd family, you know, lost their children.
Yes.
Lost everything. They are, you know, the mom still hanging on to her life. We'll link you to their FundMe page. But as you pointed out, you know, losses across the board. And what happens there? I mean, you know, just even a loss of a record and you're trying to get insurance or you're trying to get your kids, you know, vaccines. Or, you know, I'm just trying to think of the different things that get lost. What kinds of problems come up?
Well, you know, the first few weeks we had actually almost the first 2 months almost, we had local assistance centers where people could walk in and get services from the Department of Motor Vehicles, from FEMA, small business loans. Could literally get records from the county in terms of birth certificates, death certificates, marriage certificates. And it was a one-stop shop. And we had over 5,000 people that applied through FEMA assistance and literally thousands of individuals and families that went through those local assistance centers. So now the other thing that a lot of people don't think about unless you've gone through this type of catastrophic fire is just removing debris. Literally millions of tons of burnt, not just homes, but metal, car, you name it, toxic material. So even before removing the debris, the Environmental Protection Agency has had to go in and make sure that all that hazardous material was removed. So it's actually like a three-step process until that property is turned back over to the owner of it that they can then do what they want to with it, either sell or to rebuild. And then the insurance companies too, and making sure that people had enough insurance. About 22% of the people who lost homes or more were renters. Mm. And most of those people did not have insurance. The Journey's End, which is a mobile home park where 150 seniors lost their homes. So we're talking about our most vulnerable populations that have lost everything. We have some very generous people, and we've had philanthropic investments in the community to a tune of well over $20 million. Mm. So the community has really come together in a wonderful way, but we're also grieving as a community because this fire has touched every single one of us. I did a speech before the Sutter Medical Doctors Group about 2 weeks ago. And after talking about the need to grieve as a community and not to grieve alone, I then made a passionate plea for them to stay because doctors are mobile. They can move. They can find other jobs. Mm. And we need them to stay. One out of six doctors lost their homes.
Wow. I mean, just don't think about these things. And are you worried? It is just beautiful, a beautiful part of the country. But do you worry that people will leave, not just because of having lost everything, but the fear, you know, of, you know, should we rebuild? What if it happens again?
Yeah. What if it happens again? Well, I think we want to, you know, our motto has been with the city of Santa Rosa that we want to rebuild fast and we want to rebuild safer too. And I think all of those codes that have come into play since they first built those homes are going to assist. But there's no doubt that there are certain areas in our county that are always going to be riskier in terms of fire hazards. Now, we don't have tornadoes here in Sonoma County, but we do have fires, we do have droughts, and we do have earthquakes. And you don't often get to prepare for an earthquake or a fire like you can for when you know a hurricane's going to hit. Hmm. So it's difficult to prepare for that, but we do have to look at where we're rebuilding. And we also have to empower every single homeowner to build to rebuild, and then how do we make sure that they have good, solid, temporary housing? Yeah. Most people that I know who lost their homes have lived in 3 to 6 different places in just a matter of 5 weeks. And that's crazy. You know, if you can imagine moving your dog and your cat and your kids, it's something that it never leaves my mind. It's with me every single hour of the day. So I have a big job ahead of me, and I want to realize that hope does have a time limit. That's important, I think, for us to recognize that right now.
Shirley Zane, supervisor of Sonoma County's District 3. I'll say to you what we said in October. Our thoughts are with you still, I can hear, having a profound effect on you and everyone there. Yeah. So best of luck to you in the new
year. Thank you. Thank you. Don't forget us. We're here. Yeah.
Next week, government prosecutors will go before a federal judge and ask her to allow them to retry Nevada cattleman Cliven Bundy and two of his sons for crimes related to that 2014 armed standoff with government officials at their ranch in Nevada. The judge dismissed the case on December 20th after ruling that prosecutors violated the civil rights of the defendants by withholding evidence. You remember the story. For decades, Bundy grazed his cattle on federal land but refused to pay government fees because he claims he inherited water rights to the property. In recent years, there has been a push by many like him, conservatives, who want to transfer public lands out of federal control. But that's generated tremendous pushback from a group that's usually reliably conservative, hunters. Stephanie Joyce from the KUOW podcast Terrestrial brings us the story of one hunter who has risked friendships to fight to keep lands public.
There's nowhere Ty Stubblefield feels more comfortable than in the woods.
You know, being out here where we're at right now just calms my soul. And honestly, there's no place I'd rather be.
It's just after sunrise, and we're hiking up the side of a mountain on the outskirts of Missoula, Montana. Stubblefield is 6 foot with a big red beard. He sniffs the air.
Something's dead. I can smell something. Deer got hit or something.
This is his bi-weekly training hike, and Stubblefield is carrying 40-pound weights in an army green rucksack. We're both sweating. But this is nothing compared to a typical day of hunting.
Elk can cover some ground, you know. They'll cover 10 miles in a day like it's no big deal. So you have to be able to do the same.
When we pause for a minute to catch our breath, a passing hiker asks Stubblefield about his pack.
Overnight backpack, my goodness.
Training, the van's in training.
Little training. What are you training for?
Hunting.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that required training.
Have a good day. That was a funny reaction. Oh, hunting. Didn't know that required training.
Stubblefield is used to people stereotyping hunters, but it still frustrates him. He wishes more hikers and bikers and kayakers knew the role that hunting had played in the creation of public lands. Teddy Roosevelt pushed federal policy towards keeping land for national parks and forests, in large part because of his experiences as a hunter. And today, it's hunting groups who are among the most vocal advocates for keeping those lands under federal control. Stubblefield works for the loudest of them, a group called Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. But growing up in Oregon in a small timber town, he wasn't always such a proponent of federal control.
Through the course of my, you know, young adult life, I literally have done everything in the timber industry, from, you know, cutting the trees down to skidding them to loading them on the trucks to hauling them, you know, and everything in the mill, just about.
Within the timber industry, many people blame federal environmental regulations for the drop-off in logging in recent decades. Supporting federal control of the land is not a popular position. When he was younger, Stubblefield mostly stayed out of the political fray and focused on his passion, hunting. Then, a few years back, something big happened. Timber companies in Oregon started restricting hunter access to their properties.
So you started realizing how valuable those federal public lands are.
Valuable because they're the only place where access is guaranteed for hunters. That realization left Stubblefield in a tough place, having to choose between the community he grew up in and his love of hunting. Things came to a head for him when Oregon decided to sell the 80,000-acre Elliott State Forest. The timber industry was all for it, as were most of Stubblefield's family and friends. Selling it meant more logging and therefore more jobs and more revenue to communities in the region. But selling it also meant hunters might not be allowed. So Stubblefield found himself advocating for the land to stay under government control, even if that meant it wouldn't be logged.
I've definitely had some people that we've severed ties to. You know, it got to the point where they started calling me an environmentalist because I wanted my public lands to stay public.
And it wasn't just Facebook friends who were mad. Stubblefield says even his best friend, who he used to run a logging company with, felt betrayed.
He was pretty angry at me for the stance.
In the end, Oregon reversed its decision to sell the Elliott State Forest. It will stay public. But Stubblefield doesn't think this is the last time he'll find himself at odds with people he cares about over this issue. When we were out hiking, I asked him, what would he do if the Trump administration decided to transfer, sell off all public lands?
There's enough people that outside of myself, outside of the hunting community, that value our lands the way they are now, that it would be an all-out war, I think. Our land, our federal public lands right now is what shaped America. It is why we are who we are today. So to change that now, I'm scared that they're trying to do that. I just can't see it happening. I just can't fathom that changing.
Which is why Stubblefield is keeping a close eye on changes to how federal lands are managed. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And Stephanie's story comes to us from the KUOW podcast, Terrestrial. For more and to leave your thoughts, go to hearnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson's off on this New Year's Day. This is Here and Now.